Coming up on Boston Public Radio, on the same day next year we vote for a new governor, it's likely we'll be voting on whether to repeal the state's casino laws. We'll ask one of the people on that ballot, Republican candidate for Governor Charlie Baker, how he'd vote, and then we'll ask you. And the Globe's Alex Beam joins us to talk Pope envy, the Tsarnaevs, and great inflation at Harvard.
Doris Kearns Goodwin on her newest amazing book on American presidents, The Bully Pulpit and the Golden Age of American Journalism. Then Kara Miller on the minimum wage fight and the increasing gap between the haves and have-nots. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
So we all know where Governor Deval Patrick stands on casinos. He's told us many times. He sees them as one-stop shopping for job creation. He obviously signed the law and bringing big money to the Bay State. But where do the candidates who are running to fill Patrick's seat come down on casinos? Do they see it as a last resort? Is it a smart fiscal move? And will they support an effort to repeal the law altogether on next November's ballot? In a couple of minutes, we're going to talk to a Republican gubernatorial candidate, Charlie Baker, about where he is. But we figure on a day where there is a Globe headline saying yet another huge story in casinos, gambling panel chair that Steve Crosby has been with us many times, to recuse himself from Everett Site Review. We want to know where you are today at 877-301-8970. It seems to me there's three choices, Marjorie, assuming this question makes its way to the ballot. They did get enough signatures, so that's done.
Yes,
but
did.
Martha Coakley says it violates the Constitution, the Attorney General, so the Supreme Judicial Court will have to decide in fairly short order, does it make its way onto the ballot? If it does, the same day you vote for a governor and a lieutenant governor and a treasurer and a whatever, you're going to be voting on a bunch of ballot questions, including whether or not to repeal the whole casino law. We'll get to you guys in a couple of seconds at 877-301-8970. But first, as I promised, and he's delivering, joining us on the phone is the Republican gubernatorial candidate. He would be Charlie Baker. Hello again, Charlie.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Hi, Charlie.
Marjorie, how are you doing?
I'm doing very, very
well. By the
way,
much more energy in the how are you doing to Marjorie, but I'll let that pass, Charlie.
It's okay. I think I deserve more energy, Charlie. It's okay.
So that is surprising. That is, Jim, he's so sensitive about this stuff.
I am. I monitor those, Charlie Baker.
So, Charlie, you said repeatedly when you were running for governor before that you thought the best idea was to start with one casino, to have just one casino. But now we read a piece yesterday which kind of made me think that you were in favor of this repeal, this ballot question that would repeal all casinos. Are you in favor of that ballot question? Should we repeal the casino law?
I am definitely in favor of that ballot question getting on the ballot. I know there's some debate about whether or not there's a legal question that's been raised by the Attorney General's office about whether there's an implied contract there. I definitely think if you collect that many signatures on an issue like that, and given what I understand about the so-called contract question, I think the voters ought to have a shot at this one. And I think, frankly, the voters ought to have a shot on it for a lot of reasons. In addition to the fact that some of the early returns on some of these votes has indicated that maybe there's not as much enthusiasm for this people might have thought in the first place. I do want to see the thing play out a little bit, only because it's conceivable at this point that we might be in a no casino environment by that time anyway.
You mean because there nobody's left standing? Is that your point? Because at the moment, for example, in Eastern Masters, only Everett, Revere is an iffy proposition. So that's where you're going, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the Springfield one has issues as well. So I just think, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, I'm assuming most people are going to make a decision about whether or not to vote for or against me sometime between now and next year, but it's probably going to be a little closer to Election Day. So my thought on the ballot question generally, and on this one in particular, is I want to see how some of the cards unfold. But as I said, Jim, on your show a few weeks ago, I'll certainly consider it, and I absolutely believe the question should be on the ballot, and the voters should have a chance to make the call.
Hey, you'll absolutely consider what, Charlie? I wasn't clear.
Voting for the
voting for it.
Okay.
You know, Charlie, to borrow a phrase from some Washington Republicans, the infamous repeal and replace, obviously applying to something totally different, Why doesn't Charlie Baker, as candidate, stick to your guns from 3.5 years ago or 4 years ago and say, let's repeal this and replace it with one casino? Meaning if you vote with me, Charlie Baker, on November of whatever it is next year to repeal this law altogether, I will file a bill the day I'm sworn in as governor, which will do what I wanted done 3 years ago, which was the wiser move to allow for one casino. Let's see how it works. If it's great, we'll do more. If it's not so great, we're only stuck with one. Hello?
Jim, I may, in fact, end up in a situation like that. It's just not where I am today.
Okay.
I mean, let's let some of the cards unfold.
Yeah.
Okay?
Have you been surprised by this, Charlie? I mean, that there has been not the reception some of us might have anticipated to these casinos.
Well, the reason I was thinking one in the first place was because I expected and anticipated that as this kind of issue got closer and closer, a lot of people might, for a bunch of, I think, pretty good reasons, have cold feet about some of it. So, no, I haven't been surprised by the fact that a bunch of folks, when they've gotten a good up-close look at this, have had second thoughts. I mean, most people I know have had an opportunity to walk the main streets and hit some of the restaurants that exist in East Boston, right?
Yep.
I mean, it's really, there's a lot of great stuff going on there. And I was always worried about this notion of doing a whole bunch of casinos and the impact it would have on all of the existing businesses that buy for that entertainment dollar that people have. And I think in the East Boston case, that absolutely was part of the concern that people had heading down the stretch on that. And that's part of the reason why I think giving the voters a shot at this is a good idea.
We're talking with Charlie Baker, who is running for governor on the Republican side. Charlie, we learned this morning that this—
I must say, by the way, Jim, that your notion about how to frame that whole thing, that was pretty clever.
Thank you.
How long did it take you to come up with that?
Since about June, but I finally perfected it, so I think—
So, Charlie, we learned this morning that the state gambling chief, Steve Cross, we've had him on the show many times. Actually, we tried to get him today. He can't join us today. But that he's a longtime friend and former business partner of one of the owners of the 29-acre site in Everett where a casino might be located. Do you think he now has to withdraw from deliberations about the Everett site or any site in eastern Massachusetts?
He did make a decision to withdraw, didn't he?
To recuse himself just on the land,
land
sighting issue, not on the larger issue, ultimately, of whether Everett gets the Eastern Mass Casino. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I guess a friend of his. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
I think these are such pitched battles, and the debates and the push and the pull and the tug associated with them is so intense that. Yeah, at a minimum, he ought to be out of the land dispute, and he probably ought to seriously consider. By the way, I like Steve Gross.
So do we.
I've known him for years. He's an honorable, honest guy, okay? But, you know, even the appearance on some of this stuff, I think it's a little complicated.
So the sentence you interrupted yourself, you said it would probably be, you were about to say it would probably be better if he recused himself from the whole Eastern Massachusetts vote. Is that where you're going?
I was going to say he ought to put serious consideration into that and maybe even seek a legal opinion on it.
Hey. Well, you know, it's interesting because he had a business dealings with the guy that's involved with Everett, but he's also, as the story pointed out, a longtime friend and actually a former Harvard football teammate, apparently, of Joe O'Donnell, who's one of the principal owners of Suffolk Downs. Not the same as a business deal, obviously, but, you know, he's got connections there, and he had connections up in Milford where the casino just went down, knows the attorney representing some interests up there. So it is kind of incestuous,
you know,
I guess.
That does raise an interesting issue. I remember when they were trying to find people to serve on, when I was in state government, we were trying to find people to serve on a healthcare panel.
Yep.
And you couldn't have anybody on the panel who had any conflicts, but you were trying to find people who had very specific experiences and knowledge and understanding of healthcare generally. And ended up being almost everybody we found was like over the age of 65 and retired because anybody who actually was still in the biz didn't qualify. And, you know, this is a tough question because sometimes you end up putting yourself in a position where you literally can't find anybody who has enough experience in the space to actually do the job. I didn't realize that Steve had that many relationships. You know, Maybe the best thing for him to do is seek an opinion from somebody.
Well, I think he got an ethics commission opinion that I believe the story in the Globe, Marjorie, correct me if I'm wrong, said he didn't have to recuse himself even in the land deal, but because he was concerned about the appearance of impropriety,
yes,
that he was recusing himself at least from that decision, but not the larger decision about who gets the casino.
They actually did say that he could actually.
The commission already said that it was okay for him to I'm okay with him staying involved too, then, if they've already
Okay. Charlie, you said how long was I working on that line a minute ago? The last thing I want to, you know that I'm working full time to bring the parties together as one. You're aware of that, correct?
I do know that. Yes.
Okay, fine. Now,
I didn't know that.
Well, whatever. So there's Joan Bernanke writes a piece today where she takes your former opponent, Deval Patrick, to task, saying Deval Patrick's casino confusion. The first thing she cites is he's fine with the Mashpee Wampanoags and the for the Southeast Mass site, but he's going to court to make sure that the Wampanoags of Aquino on Martha's Vineyard don't get their casino. I don't want to get into that for a second, but I want to read you one line from her thing, which I don't agree with. As you know, I'm not crazy about the whole casino law, but it is the law. Patrick said he would vote against the casino in the Berkshire town of Richmond, where he has a home. He actually said it to us a week or two ago. But he's fine with citing a gambling complex in more economically desperate communities. I don't have any problem with that. I mean, if there is a law and it turns out he wants to vote against it in his hometown, but says if people in another community want to vote for it, as they did in Everett by 86.5%, so be it. Do you have a problem with him taking that position? Is that hypocritical?
No, because I think in many respects, you got to take it, it. For some people, it will obviously be a personal issue. I guess anybody, it would be a personal issue for me if we were trying to say when Swampscott too. But I would also take into consideration all the issues associated with access and transportation and capacity to absorb it and all the rest. Part of the reason I said on your show, by the way, that I was opposed to the idea of doing one on Martha's Vineyard was because I just said, I don't understand how that can really work just from a logistical point of view. I don't think that's a hypocritical position. I think the more hypocritical position would be to say that people don't have the right to vote on this.
Well, hey, frankly, I think it's the position of a lot of people who voted on the casino so far, because Massachusetts voters approved in general the idea of having casinos here.
And but then still when it do came, in the polls, by the way.
Yeah, and then when it came to having them, down the street, they had a different perspective. I'm the exact same way. I wouldn't want one in my hometown, but if my former hometown of Fall River wants one, let them go for it.
Charlie, how would you vote if there was a proposal for one in Swampscott?
I would probably vote against it. But the reason I would vote against it would be because Swampscott is 3 square miles and has – actually, Swampscott's 3 square miles and has 14,000 people. I mean, there isn't – we just don't have any land. And by the way, there's only one road into Swampscott, which is Route 1A.
Boy, a pain in the neck of a commute.
So some of those people just have to move to Lynn,
Charlie.
Thank you
so much for reminding me. And by the way, we're all looking forward to the Callahan Tunnel being closed.
You know, Charlie, I think if you win, you're going to have to get a pied-à-terre in the Back Bay.
Hey, Charlie, we really appreciate your time. Charlie Baker, Republican, running for governor of the Commonwealth. Charlie, thanks. Good to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Charlie Baker.
And by the way, Charlie will join us next Wednesday to talk about his campaign in depth. He'll be on the show talking about a whole spectrum of things, including his choice of lieutenant governor candidate the other day and a whole host of issues. But now it's your turn at 877-301-8970. Assuming this question makes it to the ballot, and Charlie and I both mentioned, it may not. The SJC may rule that Martha Coakley is right, that it does violate the Constitution. We don't have to go into the reasons why. Would you vote for this thing? Would you vote to repeal the whole law, which could lead to one of two consequences, either no casinos and slot parlors in Massachusetts, or the thing that Charlie made fun of me about, the repeal and replace thing, which is maybe it's Charlie Baker, maybe it's a Democrat who says, let's start more modestly. Let's do one casino and see how it works, which frankly, as I've said for about a year, I think is the sanest position. It was the sanest position when Baker was running against Patrick, and it's the sanest position now. 877-301-8970. Where are you on the casino thing with about 11 months to go until it goes to the ballot? And by the way, there's a big story about casinos almost every single day. I mean, right. There's almost not a day that you pick up the paper. We were talking to, you know,
well, there was a great piece in the Herald this morning where Brian Leary, one of the attorneys that's involved with the Suffolk Downs Revere situation, is saying that he sees no reason why, if there ends up being a casino in Revere, Boston isn't entitled to a lot of the, what do you call the money that they get for
mitigation?
Mitigation.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's been one of the big issues. That does Boston see nothing and Revere sees everything? He says he thinks Boston is certainly entitled to get a lot of money. So that's a whole new twist that may make people's attitudes different. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. But what I just said, I think, is how lots of people feel.
Which is,
you want them in places that want them. I mean, if Everett wants a casino, and Everett, 86% of the people in Everett want a casino, let Everett have a casino.
Well, what happens when you live across the border? For example, if this casino, if the gaming commission says it's okay not to have another vote and not to negotiate a new host agreement with Revere so they can be in the mix. So then it'd be Suffolk Downs at Revere and Everett would be the two finalists. It's literally inches, not quite, but close to inches away from East Boston. So what you have is you have the worst of the casino without the best, meaning all the revenues.
Right.
So when you say, and this is part of my problem with the law, my sense was if they had a democratic process, which I obviously totally support, small d democratic, it should have been regional. Meaning you shouldn't just get a vote if you're in the town where it's cited. Obviously, it's the most extreme impact, both positive and negative. But if it's on the border, as this Revere thing would be, this has a huge impact on the same community that just voted by 12 percentage points in East Boston against the thing. So I think that's a real, in my opinion, a real flaw with law. 877-301-8970. And Charlie's right. A lot's going to happen. Charlie Baker's right. A lot's going to happen between now and next November. But we're here to talk about where you are on December something, I guess the 5th, or what day is today? 7th. I don't know what day today is. Of 5th, thank you.
Thank you.
2013. I know what month it is,
okay.
Marjorie, so don't be
That's
so upset
good.
With me.
I don't know what day it is, Jim. Are you kidding? I think it's Thursday. I know that much.
Let's take a couple
Steve,
of
calls. Steve from Taunton, you are a potential place where one of the casinos could be. What do you think about this, Steve?
Well, I voted against it, and I don't mind casinos in general, but here in Taunton, they put it right smack in the middle of a neighborhood within feet from schools. So that made no sense to me. If they wanted a place when someplace with a tract of land someplace with easy access that was far enough situated away from the community, that would have been fine.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you still may get one in Taunton, you know, if the Mashpee Wampanoags end up getting the Southeast Mass Casino, that's where they're trying to place this thing. I assume obviously you know that.
Right, I do. Okay. And it all depends on the feds and all that.
Right.
That stuff. But, you know, everyone is affected by NIMBY, okay?
Right.
Not in my backyard, yep.
Even Ted Kennedy was affected by NIMBY and the windmills.
With the wind farms.
That is true.
Down off
Hyannisport,
right.
Yep.
So that's not unusual.
No.
But if I had to have voted, if there's going to be a referendum here in Massachusetts on whether to repeal or replace the casino option, I'd vote against it because that way you can't go wrong, in my opinion.
Wait, you'd vote against the meaning allow the law to stand, or you'd vote against
the law?
That's
right. I'd vote against the law to stand. You know what? In my opinion, lottery tickets and all that stuff preys upon the poor. That's just my own personal.
Well, by the way, it's not your opinion, Steve. In fact, a study was done a number of years ago when Tom Birmingham was in the Senate that shows that people in Chelsea and Holyoke, for example, two of the poorest communities in the state, spend much, much more of their money on lottery tickets than do people in wealthy suburbs, even though people in wealthy suburbs get some of the benefit through local aid. Steve, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Why are you smirking?
Because naturally you're going to spend more in poor – people are going to spend more in poor communities because they're poor.
But it's like Robin Hood in reverse, Marjorie. Essentially, people in the poorest communities in Massachusetts support schools in the wealthiest towns through the lottery.
They're over 21, and if they want to go out and buy a scratch ticket, if they want to go out and buy 10 scratch tickets, I mean, you are not the person to tell them.
You don't think there's a more equitable way to raise money for government services?
Yeah.
Having...
I thought the income tax should be raised in Massachusetts, but that got nowhere, did it?
No, it did not.
Okay, let's go to Jim in southern New Hampshire. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I think I'm with you, Marjorie. I like what I just heard from you. What my comment is, two comments. Number one, there's an awful lot of hypocrisy going on. And number two, there's a lot of misconception about gambling. We're not trying to close every liquor store, and liquor is a problem just like gambling is. And I mean, I have a problem with Marty Walsh. Number one, I'm a recovering alcoholic. I've been sober over 20 years, and I'm not preaching about the evils of alcohol, and neither is Marty Walsh. But he's preaching about the evils of gambling. So,
By the way, Marty Walsh, I hate to correct you, Marty Walsh is not preaching about the evils of gambling. He, in fact, wanted the casino in East Boston. He's saying if it's not going to be in East Boston, he wants to make sure that the negative effects of a casino in a surrounding community don't trickle down to Boston. So I just want to be clear where he is on this. But go ahead, Jim.
That's a good point, Jim, and I'm glad you made that point and reappraised my opinion of Mr. Walsh, which now is elevated way more than it was. But that brings me to my second point, which is that people have this misconception about gambling. You know, maybe the first gambling casinos on the East Coast were Atlantic City. Atlantic City was already a pretty bad area. I mean, it was a depressed area. There was a lot of, whenever you have a depressed community, there's more crime and stuff like that. I don't hear about the people in Connecticut complaining about all the crime that's associated with Monhegan's Sun. And I see it as an economic engine.
Well, Jim, let me just say, though, if I may, one of the most famous quotes about Atlantic City, and I used to spend my summers there, was by a professor at UMass Amherst. And this is almost a verbatim quote. Atlantic City used to be a slum by the ocean. Now it's a slum by the ocean with casinos. And his point is, and I have to say, as someone who's been there, Atlantic City is not a better place because there are casinos all along the boardwalk. In some communities it may be, but Atlantic City isn't one of them. Jim, thank you very much for the call.
On the other hand, you go to these poor towns that are very desperate, that are in terrible shape, and if they think they could get some more jobs there.
Well, under the current law, that's exactly right. And we should say, for those who are frustrated, we can get into more things with Charlie Baker. Again, he will be with us next Wednesday, and we'll do the full spectrum with him.
But when we come back, it is time for Open Mic with Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam. He's tapped into something that's plaguing everybody but the Catholics. That's Pope Envy. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 for Open Mic is Alex Beam. Why do we call him Alex Beam, you might ask? I think, Marjorie, you would agree. It's not because it's his birth name, but because he's like a sunbeam roadster with Alex. The top is down. His wit blows through your hair as he drives the conversation with agility and speed. Alex Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe, and he's the author of many books. Alex, nice to see you.
Who wrote that, Jim? That's unbelievable.
Doesn't matter
pathetic.
Who wrote it, does it?
That was beautiful.
I think it was quite touching.
That was a beautiful
actually.
Tribute yeah, to Alex. But Alex, I understand, despite the sunbeam that you are, that you've been in a bit of a funk because you, as an Episcopalian, and your Mormon friends, and apparently some of your Jewish friends, are suffering from Pope Envy. Now, please explain.
Pope Envy. Yeah, I came across this. I was reading a blog called Mormon Feminist Housewives.
I love it.
You'll want to set your browser to stun. I read that. There's something called the Blogger Knackle. Anyway, this really, really active Mormon blogosphere. And it led me to this piece by this actually pretty well-known writer named Jana Rice. I've met her, but I don't know how to pronounce her name.
She's a good writer. Good writer.
Yeah, yeah. And she wrote this powerful piece, very powerful for Mormons, about Pope Envy. And we can describe that. But, of course, I couldn't squeeze a column out of it until I got a second example because, you know, one thing is isolation, two things, of course, is a column.
That's
because
right.
I could always.
A
I
trend.
Could always, yeah, trend. So I did find somehow, but thanks to Google, I found a second analogous column, really well, also really well written, really forceful piece of writing by a Rabbi Jeffrey Salkin from Los Angeles, who in the course of his column expressed that he envies the Catholics, this incredibly assertive, you know, Pope who seems to know what he wants to do, is taking tremendous spiritual and moral leadership role. And so that's what I wrote the column about.
Yeah, well, it's true. The big question I always wonder with Catholics, of course I am one, is how they overcome the problem of the bad music and the bad sermons in so many of the masses in these outlying churches. You know, you go for a spiritual experience and the singer who's leading the songs is one half pitch off, yeah. And you get your fingers in your ears. You know,
what I'm Episcopalians
saying?
Don't have that problem.
You have beautiful choirs.
We have amazing music.
You have amazing music, I know.
We're there for the music, I assure you.
You know, while I experience, as a Jew turned sort of agnostic, I really do experience Pope Envy too. Even though I have to say, Alex, I want to be honest with you, I found your column to be, I don't know how I should put this, Odios. Did you not find that to be the case, Martin?
I thought of that, Jim. That's a brilliant point.
Now, did you do that for us? Did you insert that little baby there for us?
I have been
us
waiting 8 years to make this a ridiculous play on words where I contrast the cliche comparisons are odious with this invented phrase, comparisons are OTOs, which means
useless,
irrelevant.
Yeah. I had to look it up.
I'm so happy to see that in print. That's a reader minimizer.
There's another word I didn't understand in here. Was it S-E-R-R-I-E-D? Serried? Is that it?
Serried. Yeah, that's a pompous word. It just means gathered together. It's totally inappropriate in that context, but I just fell in there.
You should only read Alex on a Kindle, by the way, Margie, so that you can press the word and then you get the definition.
Is that otherwise, what they do on Kindle?
Yeah.
A lot of people just don't read Alex at all. That addresses the problem square on.
By the way, that is the voice of Alex, being from the Boston Globe. Alex, you have written... Yeah. Repeatedly through the years about the world's greatest university. Do you hear what Harvey Mansfield, a long timer over there at Harvard, wrote about? It was in the Globe, actually, on Wednesday, about grade inflation and how appalled he was at some faculty meeting when he asked and heard that essentially the grade that is given almost across the board are A's. At Harvard, he said he gives two different grades, a grade
that
so that it doesn't
incredible
ruin their lives, and then he gives them a real grade, meaning what they actually earned, which is even more unbelievable. What was your reaction to both?
Well, Mansfield needs no introduction, of course. He's a sort of a serious conservative philosopher and historian and scholar. I am aware that it has been revealed that the average grade at Harvard is now an A-.
No, that he specifically in this piece in the Globe, he said, quote, "I thought the most prevalent grade was an A-, which is bad enough," this is Mansfield speaking. "When I asked the question about the most frequently given grade, it was actually worse," meaning an A.
Okay.
A.
Yeah, I mean, he's a compulsive truth teller, I mean, which is why he's, of course, marginalized. I don't know. What can you say? I mean, I have a son who's in a great undergrad. He's at Pomona College. It's just a wonderful,
California, right?
Yeah, small.
Yeah, small, wonderful undergraduate institution. And the minute since he's out of the country, I can speak candidly. I mean, you know, the professors just don't want to give low grades that begin with the first letter of my last name.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just how, no one likes to dump on Harvard more than I do, but this is happening at
everywhere.
Schools everywhere.
But doesn't
quote unquote quality schools, quote unquote unquality.
Yeah.
Doesn't
you
Mansfield undercut his own credibility, though, when he says in this piece in the Globe, he gives two different grades, I said, one that shows up in the transcript and one he believes they actually deserve. Well, if they actually deserve it, why don't they get it?
Well, that's sort of a scandal. I agree with you. And I mean, as a tenured professor of some repute, I'm sort of if he really wanted to lead by example, like Pope Francis, of course, he would be the one, he would say, look, I'm a conservative by nature with all that means. I'm going to give you the grade you deserve. And if you get a B- from me, it means you wrote a good essay on Plato.
But you know why this happens. I mean, in large part now is because of the extraordinary amount of money everybody's paying to go to these schools. I mean, I've heard people talk about how when their kid got, God forbid, a B- or hell's about to break out everywhere, a C, and they give money to the college, they are on the phone in 2 seconds to the president's office and the dean of students complaining
about
it.
How humiliated does a normal child have to be? And if they're not humiliated, how deranged does a child have to be when their parent is calling to complain about their grade?
Well, Marjorie's right. I mean, it happens a lot. And, of course, the back end is, the grad school application. I mean, you got to wonder, what are grad schools sort of thinking when they see that every man and woman coming out of and has an A average?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to assume then a kind of code sets in, where you can use phrases in the recommendations that kind of code the candidate down a little bit and say, brilliant, but didn't always put in her best effort or something. Even, someone might sue you for saying that.
Well, you know what else is terrible about it? If you happen to have a kid who maybe is not taking full advantage of their educational opportunities and maybe a little bit too busy on the partying front, they're not getting the backhand that they should for spending too much time partying. I mean, my kids tell me some of their grades. I think, really? Really? From what I know is going on? It's not a good thing for the kids.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. But I've seen it, and I mean, It's regrettable. Blah blah blah, and it's everywhere. It's omnipresent.
What year is your kid at Pomona?
He's a junior.
Well, let me just give you a fair warning here. My best friend in law school was Jake Smith. He went to Pomona.
Okay.
When I got to NYU Law School on day one, I walked into the library. There was a guy, and this is a true story, in overalls, bare feet, and a straw hat. And that was
it's like Mr.
Jake
Green Jeans.
Smith, bare feet in the library, a graduate of Pomona College.
Oh, my
Jacob
goodness.
Smith was his name. So that's what we have in store for you somewhere down the line.
I'll tell you one thing that's weird is that they have, you know, Parents Weekend, and we go every year.
Oh, not why not?
Not just freshmen. It's like a botanical garden.
It's unbelievable.
And they hold it in February. It's like evil genius.
Now, where is it in relation to Los Angeles, Pomona?
It's about 40 miles east, yes. Counterintuitively.
Oh, it's in southern. I thought it was in north.
It's in southern California.
And it's called, isn't it one of the, what
yes.
are they called? Those
they're called
three,
the five C's.
Of them there?
Yeah. I mean, I don't quiz me, but the Claremont College.
College.
They're all great
right.
colleges. Yeah. I think my favorite, though, is University of California at Santa Cruz.
Everyone likes that.
Now,
yeah.
you're above the most righteous wave beach, of course, in all of Northern California,
righteous.
As opposed to the rude waves. Well, now they probably have different expressions. I'm dating myself, but that was it. You know, if you're riding around the Woody, as I did with the boyfriend from Hawaii.
Now, is that the beach
the
where
right...
you posed nude in this famous picture that everyone
nude.
Has seen?
Excuse me, can I clarify
no,
that? There was not a photograph.
Not true.
I will clarify it. Her college roommate.
We were
roommate.
Meditating.
Excuse
back
me.
To back.
That's what they call
Marjorie's
it.
Hawaiian college boyfriend.
That's right.
And she are written about in her, what's your roommate's name from college?
I'm not going to tell you.
Just say what the woman's name is. She's
we need
best
this
selling
for Googling
author.
Purposes.
What's her name?
I'm not telling you.
Well, we'll
you
look
go look it up.
In any case, she wrote a book, and in the book is
it's
a story of Marjorie and her Hawaiian boyfriend, surfer boyfriend, sitting back to back. There's no photograph.
That's right.
Next to his Woody, meaning his car.
The Woody.
His
the
car.
He had a Woody.
Oh,
it's like a Gidget movie.
And they are naked. I mean,
we're
it
not
is
naked.
What it is. You are.
We're
I
doing transcendental meditation.
The way you use the adjective righteous, Marjorie, I mean, the whole Beach Boys second album just unreal.
And you know, with the puka shells and little gold flecks in their hair. It was unbelievable.
Did
I
he
tell
wear,
you.
Use patchouli oil too, or did he not?
I don't remember the patchouli oil, but I do remember the tan.
In any case, we'll get the name of the author and we'll give it to you by
and we'll get
tomorrow.
The internet site, I hope.
Yeah. Hey, to move to a serious topic, not that that wasn't for a second, Tom Gagin, formerly of the editorial board of your paper, wrote a piece asking questions that are not being answered about what happened on late the week of April 15th, particularly in Watertown with the police when the younger Tsarnaev was finally captured in the boat. And by the way, while he wrote a great piece, I should say, Philip Martin and some of our colleagues at WGBH have been
job.
Writing about
great
all
job.
The unanswered questions. We talk to Deval Patrick about this all the time. We talk to Brian McGrory, current editor of The Globe, about this all the time. Why is it that so few questions are being answered about what happened that week, what happened with Todashev in the apartment in Orlando? It's almost as if one is seen as anti-off-police, unpatriotic.
You are.
If you have the temerity to say, we need to know what happened that day and if some things went wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, the two of you are just as qualified as I am to talk about this. I had conveniently forgotten the unbelievable kind of X-Files nature of the Todashev incident, which, again, is almost a complete question mark. And, you know, where the FBI shoots, frankly, a key witness in the whole Tsarnaev.
Multiple times.
With many different stories about what he had, what he didn't have, who was in the room. Martha Coakley, as Attorney General, was a request from the Civil Liberties Union that she investigate because two troopers, even if they weren't in the room at that
troopers.
Time, were in the apartment.
Well, in a sense, let me ask
she
you.
She says she doesn't have jurisdiction.
I mean, what does McGrory say? I mean, he wouldn't. The question is, you know, is the Globe spotlight team sort of on the case? I think I really respected Gagin for writing this piece. I was thinking of writing it. I don't think I have the stones to write that because, you know, you're kind of shouted down as, you know, it's questioning the police in a time of this and that. I was very impressed with his totally reasonable critique. He left out the Todashev killing, which was nuts. He also left out the incredible intelligence failure, which becomes even more fascinating post-Snowden, although the failure was pre-Snowden, meaning that, of course, we listened to every phone call of the older Tsarnaev guy between Cambridge and Dagestan, where he then goes for some mysterious training for X number of months. I mean, and then the CIA says we were quite aware of this. I mean, Tom Gagin doesn't get to this other unbelievable.
Well, we have gotten to that other point. Bill Keating is a congressperson from Massachusetts who went to Russia after April 15th. We've had him on the show. Keating told us recently, this is staggering to me, and I can't believe it's not getting more play. He writes a letter to the FBI. I think I'm going to get this 99% right. Marjorie, you'll correct me if I'm wrong. Writes a letter to the FBI asking a bunch of questions about, you know, what did they know? Did they share it? All this sort of thing. Gets no answer. The committee on which he serves invites the FBI to testify. They refuse to come. The committee on which he serves then invites the FBI to testify behind closed doors. There's no press. They refuse to come. The fact that after probably one of the great atrocities of at least 2013, if not a larger period of time, happened, and virtually no one other than Keating, a few reporters, are willing to even ask the questions, and most elected officials with whom we talk, most of them, if not virtually all of them, don't even want to know what the truth is about what happened.
One quick aside. When you talk to law enforcement people off the record, lots of them have nothing but disrespect for the FBI in areas like this when it comes to cooperating and sharing information.
How about Ed Davis when he's in front of the Congressional Committee?
I was going to bring up Davis's name. I mean, what this guy thinks he's going to be the next chief of Homeland Security. I don't think he was totally candid about what information he got.
Well, he was candid in front of that Congressional Committee when testifying, saying that the Joint Terrorism Task Force on which the Boston cops served, had they been told about these Alder Sarnaev travels, they would have visited them before the marathon. However,
as soon as
the testimony was over, he starts backtracking from all of that. Once again, I assume getting the message from somebody, you can't ask any questions.
Well, also,
but I thought it's been asserted that
they were informed, and that Davis was incorrect when he said that.
So you think that's why he backed off?
I don't know why he backed off.
I agree with Marjorie,
but he did.
But again, to go back to your initial question, I'm a little. I mean, why are these all blanks now? And again, I'll credit whoever you want me to credit: Gagin, Martin, McGrory. I mean, it's time to start filling in the blanks. I was bowled over by my friend Sean Murphy's piece a few months ago in the Globe that conclusively—
One of the great reporters,
wonderful reporter.
He is a fabulous reporter.
He is a great reporter.
You know, I know he's a friend of mine, but I mean, he's a difficult person.
Difficult person, pain in the neck, but a wonderful reporter.
I mean, he conclusively proved, I can use that term, I think, that the second officer who was mortally, albeit not fatally, wounded—
Doherty.
Was hit by
friendly fire.
Friendly
yes.
fire. So that's just not hard— You know, give us the bullet. We have that. Where's the forensics?
Well, you know what's also, can I add one more thing to this? I know we've said this a lot here, but another great piece of reporting for the New York Times. What's the name of the guy who won the Pulitzer Prize? Used to work at the Globe. Charlie Savage.
Oh, yeah.
Charlie Savage writes a piece in terms of, and I put it in the context of the FBI investigating itself vis-a-vis this Todashev thing. And by the way, if people don't remember who Todashev is, he's the person who allegedly was about to sign a confession saying that he and the Alder Sarnaev were responsible for the unsolved triple murder in Waltham on 9/11 of 2011.
Three young men.
Why that matters, of course, is because had they solved the crime prior to April 15th of this year, there would not have been a marathon bombing because the Alder Sarnaev would be in jail. But the point, Charlie Savage wrote a piece that there have been 100, and this is a few months ago, 150 incidents of someone in custody who was either killed or at least shot and not killed by the FBI. They investigated themselves in 150 out of 150 cases. They cleared themselves. What further evidence do you need that we need independent investigation of what went on?
Well, we should point out the Tom Gagin piece did say that the Kennedy School of Government is doing an investigation, that the state police are investigating, but they're essentially investigating themselves. So I'm not sure we can put all that much credence in that. And that Deval Patrick is—
Who we've asked repeatedly about it,
by the way. What does he say?
Well, he's not— He like Martha Coakley, seems to not think this is a big deal. We asked him about Todashev. Todashev said, well, he's a killer. He also said
we will learn. I believe, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but the implication I get from it is the FBI is doing its work. We will have a full array of information before, it's just not now. So
may I say one last thing about this? This is why this drives me crazy. I've said this many times before, but I'll say it again. The Atlantic magazine had a piece right after the bombing showing these different police officers from different towns in their unbelievably professional, scary-looking gear. Matching. Everyone had matching outfits. And some of them were on what looked like tanks going into the homes and not going into the homes, but knocking on the doors of people, having people run out in their bare feet in Watertown and stuff like that. The money that we are spending, now a lot of it is from Homeland Security, in fairness, but the money we're spending on these situations, which you hope are going to be unusual, cut into everything else. Right now, the Boston Police in this negotiation for the new contract are talking about, well, we have to fight terrorism. And yeah, you do, let's hope very rarely, but they're using that as an excuse for why they need more training and more guns and more weaponry. Meanwhile, you have schools in Boston falling apart, all these programs falling apart, and
The weaponization of the local police. I was actually thinking about that in context because it used to. I'm old enough to remember when it was like the LAPD, you know, that was their thing. They always had SWAT teams and they'd go in basically into some African American neighborhood.
Frank Rizzo was the police chief before he was mayor of my hometown of Philadelphia, and he went in a tank down North Broad Street into a black neighborhood when there was a spate of crime. You know, we have to move to a lighter thing before we let you go. But speaking of weaponry, I know you're a big Christmas. No, you're a big Christmas guy, right?
Oh, love Christmas.
Okay, fine. Now,
when is the column coming out about the letters that people send to Christmas?
I don't know if I can get away with that.
Yes, My son is getting a triple degree, law, medicine, and business from Harvard University.
Okay. So how do you feel about the fact that when you go on the NORAD website this year, which I know you'll be doing to track Santa on Christmas Eve,
he will be accompanied by jet fighters
and armed with cruise missiles. Wow. Is that okay with you?
It's not okay with me. It's the weaponization of Christmas. I'm against it.
Really?
Wait till Bill O'Reilly hears about this, by the way.
You know, what were they thinking of? I just don't get what they were thinking of at all.
Well, they want that ridiculously wasteful, like, joint strike fighter to get funded or something.
Isn't that one of the things where you say to yourself, when people were sitting in a room at NORAD or somewhere, and they said, I've got a great idea. This is something the little 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old kids love to do. Let's put some fighter jets alongside Santa and the... I
think it's a red state, blue state America thing. Yeah. I would imagine that in a lot of the red states in America, there are people that think their children are going to salute to Santa and the planes as they fly overhead.
You know, I signed up on the Fox News website for the email feed War on Christmas. I thought I could get a pretty good column out of it. I'm hoping the war on Christmas naturally is as intense as in but this is the war for Christmas. It's clearly some response, response to Fox News, John Gibson's groundbreaking books.
Okay, Alex Beam, thank you very much. Are we missing anything? I don't think so. We've covered our tracks.
We have 1 minute left.
We do?
Speaking of Christmas, how do you feel, Alex, about having your gifts dropped off by an octocopter this Christmas or next? I mean, are you into this Amazon? I've become so enamored of this thing, even though, as we said on the other day, it is going to be like the birds with all these drones overhead. It is. No, I'm serious. I mean, isn't there a certain allure, a certain appeal? And don't tell me it's Odios either. I mean, is there not a certain appeal of this?
No, it's some like weird publicity stunt, right? I mean, Amazon's going to be.
That's what some say.
Yeah, I don't.
We think it's happening. We believe it 100%.
I'm dying to write about drone journalism, by the way. They're teaching drone journalism.
What does that mean?
I don't know, but when I find out, I'm going to write a column about it.
I bet you are.
Yeah,
you fly overhead?
Yeah, University of Missouri has several courses on drone journalism.
Hanging off the optocopter?
I always thought it was just like drones at typewriters hanging out press
believe
releases.
Me, that's going to happen.
I'd be a little nervous, but, you know, 50 feet above the sea in case, you know, it drops me. You know what I mean? The octocopter's right now.
You won't have to leave the office.
Up to 5 pounds. Okay, now we're done with you. Alex Beam, it's been a pleasure. Boston Globe.
Okay, Alex Beam joins us every Thursday for Open Mic. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe and author of many, many books, both fiction and nonfiction.
None of which we can mention on the air.
At some point, we hope to be able to say what at least one of them is. Alex?
An upcoming one, yes.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And in the introduction to her latest terrific book, Doris Kearns Goodwin writes, quote, "There are but a handful of times in the history of our country where there occurs a transformation so remarkable that a molt seems to take place and an altered country begins to emerge." It's certainly true of the era that she writes about in The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. What is not in her introduction, though, is reciprocity. In famed anchorman Ron Burgundy's groundbreaking autobiography, in his author's note, he writes, and I quote, "It took me 8 years to write this book. The research alone, the fact-checking, reading the source materials, asking questions was endless. I didn't care for it that much. I consulted with my dear friend and lover, Doris Kearns Goodwin, over many breakfasts in bed. You know, we thought it was just coincidence. Yeah. Marjorie and I did that Ron Burgundy and Doris were in downtown Boston at the same time. Obviously, it wasn't. Doris, congratulations on the relationship and the book. It's really great news. How are you, Doris?
One is nonfiction, one is fiction. But the, well, that's what the she second says. One is lots of fun. That's what she says. Of course, that's what she'll say.
I think it's so wonderful that Ron Burgundy, Will Ferrell, and mention you and talk, you know, even though
that
he
is pretty
joking.
Great.
I mean,
no,
I'd be pretty
it's
impressed.
Really funny. I mean, he has also in their lines, you know, that she was my lover and she had more energy than I did and I couldn't keep up with her. And if she wants another bounce, she can come along. So there's lots of my friends
she
who
wants
think,
another bounce.
Another bounce.
I love
so
that.
Some of my friends think this is my greatest achievement to be his
well,
fictional lover.
It's pretty funny. And the movie, have you ever seen the movie? The movie
it's,
is
it's
a
got a cult following.
Oh,
so
God. I just love it. Very funny. So tell us about the book. You know, Jim explained a lot of that, but what's the thesis? You know, the bully pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, the golden age of journalism. What's the thesis here, Doris Kearns Goodwin?
Well, that's a great question. I haven't been asked that for so long. I feel like I'm back in school. I love it.
Okay. Well, the takeaway or the point.
No, I like that question.
No, I love the question. Okay. I think it's great. No, I think what it is that what was needed to be done at the turn of the 20th century when there was a huge gap between the rich and the poor, when there was no workman's compensation, when there was no government regulation of industry and trusts and monopolies forming everywhere, was some sort of action. And Theodore Roosevelt understood that the only way he could get the action done was by pressuring the Congress, which was an old guard Congress who wanted nothing to do with government regulation, to pressure them to bring the bills to the floor. And the only way he could do that was to make use of the bully pulpit. He's the one that defined the word as the platform a president has to educate the country. And the only way he could do that was to have a relationship with the press. And his relationship with the press is the most remarkable I've ever written about. They were his friends. They were productive, and yet they retained their integrity, and he retained his.
You know, the image that you read, the whole tell the story about how press, the primary access, and there were lots of different, one primary access that the press had to Teddy Roosevelt when he was doing what, Doris Kearns Goodwin?
Well, every day the barber would shave him in the middle of the day. And it's a straight edge, you know, razor.
Yeah.
So he's sitting in the chair. The press are all invited in to ask questions. And evidently the barber had to be a magician because Teddy's moving around talking to the press. And they have freedom to talk. Then at night when he's signing mail, they come in again. They come to lunch. They go to Sagamore Hill. He really respected writers because he was a writer. And he understood that in order for that relationship to work, he had to accept their criticism. For example, there's a famous moment when one of these great journalists who wrote Mr. Dooley, this famous character in humorist history, wrote a review of Teddy's Rough Rider book. And he said that Teddy made himself the center of attention so much that he should have called the book Alone in Cuba. So everybody's mocking Teddy, reading the book. And he writes him back and he said, I regret.
He being Roosevelt writes him
he
back.
He being
yeah.
Roosevelt
yeah.
writes him back. I regret to tell you that my entire family is delighted with your review of my book. Now you owe it to come and visit me. I've always wanted to make your acquaintance. That's inconceivable today, that kind of thick enough skin to be able to take that criticism.
Well, not only thick enough skin, we read last week that photographers are filing complaints against the Obama White House. You know, forget a coverage and access. You can't even take pictures of the president anymore. They have an official photographer who then tweets out or whatever they do photographs. So the contrast in access. How did he make the calculation that he could use, or use is probably a poor choice of words, maybe it isn't, work with, cooperate with the press to essentially pressure this government to reform itself?
Well, I think he knew that there was a group of reporters then who are now still famous in the history of journalism. Ida Tarbell, Lincoln Steffens, Ray Baker, William Allen White. I mean, they're the honored reporters. They were all at one magazine at the same time. And he understood that they were creating stories. People respond to stories, right? He needs to do something about the monopolies, but it's pretty abstract. What is a trust? What is a monopoly? Ida Tarbell writes a story showing how Standard Oil had used illegal means to get its monopoly position. And suddenly the country says, I understand that now through the person. Ray Baker writes about railroad abuses, and they finally understand it. Lincoln Steffens writes about corruption in the city. And so he knows that they are able to tell in larger fashion what he can only shorthand tell, and he values their work. So he reads proofs of their articles ahead of time, sends them his messages ahead of time, and it worked for both sides.
We're talking with Doris Kearns Goodwin, the author of many books. The newest one is The Bully Pulpit. You also talk, though, about the time that these journalists had to prepare their pieces and investigate their pieces and the length of the pieces. Tell people about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, again, to imagine today. I mean, McClure understood that they had to be fact-based and really impregnable pieces to have an impact. So he would give them sometimes 2 years as a staff reporter. He almost invented the concept of staff reporter before they had to write a word. And then their pieces would come out, stretching over 12 monthly issues, 50,000 words sometimes these pieces were. I mean, that's the problem today. Who would have the resources to give reporters that time for their investigations? And then even if they did report it, who's going to read that?
And everybody, distracted age. People were salivating over these pieces then, were they not?
Absolutely. It became the common conversation in the country.
And now we have, most of the public, and I include myself, have the attention span of gnats. And is that because there were so few competing distractions? Is that what it was?
No TVs.
This is what you're waiting for, the next Stephens piece?
No, I think you're absolutely right. Print journalism was at its heyday then, right? It's before the radio, it's before television, it's before the internet. And so people were reading a lot more in all sorts of means, reading books even more and reading print journals. And magazines with their new drawings, cartoons became so popular. And then people would talk. They'd talk at their local store about what they just read. And that's where the pressure could build up to deal with Congress.
Tell the story. I think it was Stephens. But if I'm wrong, obviously you'll correct me. Who was the person who got the note from Roosevelt?
It is Stephens.
That he was I mean, and you compare this as one does to everything that is happening now. Obviously, you can't resist, and I know you know that. But tell the story about what Roosevelt gave to Stephens.
So Stephens starts by studying corruption in the cities, and he writes the famous series of called The Shame of the Cities. Then he starts and deals with corruption at the state level, and lots of governors get undone because of what he writes. So then he decides, well, I want to study if there's corruption in the federal government. So he goes to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt gives him a note that gives him permission to talk to anybody as long as it's the truth that he's being told. And he carries that thing around him to
from
go and
the
study.
President
from
the President of the United States. Not the press secretary, from the president.
No, exactly. And Stephens and Roosevelt fought like cats and dogs. So it wasn't like this was one of his partisans. He would think Stephens was unrealistic. He eventually became sort of a socialist. He never thought he was the right kind of understanding of politics, but he respected the idea that if you find out something wrong in the federal government, even if you're the head of it, it's good for you to find that out.
Well, I don't want to move away from olden times too quickly, but I just have to ask you, because the bully pulpit is something that many presidents think they have, but we have one now that has been criticized left and right for not using it. So is he not using it, or are we not listening?
Well, wait a second. Before you answer that, he actually used it yesterday. He used it yesterday in a speech talking about what the major challenge was for the remaining 3 years in office. Let's hear a couple of seconds from the President of the United States. Here it is.
This increasing inequality is most pronounced in our country. And it challenges the very essence of who we are as a people. I believe this is the defining challenge of our time.
Okay, income inequality was a big issue back in Roosevelt and Taft's day as well. But I wanted to ask you about that question about the bully pulpit. Is he talking and we're not listening? Combination of both? What do you think? I mean, you've written about FDR, you've written about Lincoln, you're commenting on presidential politics all the time. What do you think?
Well, the interesting thing is, I think one of the things Teddy Roosevelt understood was that you had to talk in shorthand language. You had to make things crystal clear. So he would have these little sayings like the square deal or speak softly and carry a big stick. And people got it because he knew that you had to make headlines. But also his speeches would be printed in full in the newspaper. It's the first day of national newspapers, right? The first era. By the time Roosevelt comes, FDR, the radio, 80% of the people are listening to him on the radio. No interruptions. Saul Bellow said you could walk down the street and watch everybody in their little houses watching what he was doing, listening to the same voice. The early days of television up till Reagan, three networks, you're listening to the whole speech. Look what happens now. He makes a speech like yesterday. You may just watch your favorite cable network. You may not hear the whole speech. You may hear the pundits criticizing it before it's even begun. But most importantly, to go back to what you said, our attention span is such that it's going to be breaking news tomorrow, and you don't have that sustained conversation anymore. So I think it's partly the institution has been diminished now, but it's still a incredibly important tool for a president, and I think he has to use it on health care right now.
The institution of the presidency has been diminished.
No, I don't mean the whole presidency, but I mean the bully pulpit
part of it. Okay, the bully pulpit part
of it.
But how does he – let's just stay on that for a second. You mentioned he has to use it on health care. When I read the headline when I woke up the other day, I think it was 2 days ago, and it said Barack Obama going to start a relentless campaign explaining – the healthcare law that passed 34 months or 32 months ago, I thought it was the Barowitz report or something. It was just, for those who don't know, great satirical blogger, a genius, I should say. How can someone so smart not get it? Is it that he doesn't get it, that, as people say, he has contempt for both the press and for anybody who's not his wife or Valerie Jarrett? What is it? And I'm serious. What is it that causes him not to get that he's such an engaging human being and such a great teacher as he was? So teach.
I mean, it had to be done from day one. I mean, there's no question that he lost the battle for what the health care bill was all about in that summer of the town hall meetings, even before the bill passed.
Sarah Palin was doing a better job of disinformation than he was of information.
Exactly. She creates the metaphor, or whoever does, of death panels. And that was just a shorthand phrase that Teddy Roosevelt would say was a good phrase, even though it's on the opposite side, even though it may not have been factually true. So even before the health care bill passed, he did finally give a good speech to the joint session of Congress about the health care law before it passed. But then that's when Joe Wilson, the congressman, stood up and said, you lie. And that became the story. But there's been months that he has to explain this thing. Now, maybe if he breaks it down into the component parts, which are popular, I gather, from the polls, people will be able to understand, yes, I like this part of it. And even if I don't know what the whole big thing is all about.
We're talking with Doris Kearns Goodwin, whose new book is The Bully Pulpit. You started out to be doing something focusing on Roosevelt and the progressive era, and then it expanded into William Howard Taft. And I'm embarrassed to say I know next to nothing about William Howard Taft until I finished reading your book, except that he was enormous. So why the expansion to Taft?
So to speak.
yes. So
hey, excellent. Well, you do go into his diet.
Yeah, well, no, I know. He was 250 at Yale. He was 250 as Supreme Court Chief Justice, but 350 during his presidential years. So his weight was a problem. But I think what happened to me is what happens in every book. I choose these presidents who are the most written about presidents because I want to live with them. I'm going to take so long with them. And I can't just write about them because I'll just be doing what a lot of other people have done. So Lincoln becomes Team of Rivals. FDR becomes Franklin and Eleanor. And I was looking for how can I expand the cast of characters in this book. And I knew, honestly, not as much more than you did about Taft. I knew he succeeded him. I knew they ran against each other. And I knew he was fat. But then when I started reading the letters between the two of them, because I got interested in him and saw that they'd been such close friends before they broke apart in 1912 and that he'd been a critical part of Teddy's cabinet, then I said, hey, maybe I'll make him a character. And then he got more interesting to me. I felt more admiration for him. And he may have failed as a public leader, but he was a really decent, amiable, good guy.
What did you admire most?
I think I admired mostly that he was a person that when people met him, they trusted him. Teddy himself said of Taft that he envied his personality because people loved him at first sight, and where it took longer for Teddy to get into the hearts of people. And he was the best number two man. I mean, that was the problem for him in business leadership. He was perfect at every position as long as he had someone in charge because he didn't like the public spotlight. So when he became president, he felt like he was a fish out of water.
Well, you know, you say that. I'll tell you what I like best about him, that he was, because he was not the leader, as you write, that Roosevelt was. This quote is so great. When I hear someone say, Mr. President, this is Taft when he is president, I look around expecting to see Roosevelt. I mean, how great and self-whatever. It's just such a great moment.
Well, since many of us are battling weight issues, how did he lose the 100 pounds post?
Well, he was on a diet that was,
the Atkins
diet. It was almost like the Atkins diet. I mean, it was no carbohydrates and drinking lots of water. And then he had to change all of his clothes, and he had to go to the trousers, you know, and he had them all taken in. But then he started eating again, and it came all the way back. And then finally at the end, I think when he was happy. The interesting thing is when he was happy at Yale, when he was happy as Chief Justice, he was at 250, which was fine for his build. When he was unhappy and feeling nervous in the political world, he was never meant for politics. Yeah, temperament is the separator.
An emotional eater, perhaps.
An emotional eater,
yeah,
indeed.
So you know what I'm always – I mean, you obviously read a lot because you're an author. But I am always amazed when I hear it, like Roosevelt having written 40 books and then writing these voluminous letters 2 and 3 times a week to his closest friends. I know they weren't watching television, but I mean, a lot of us don't watch that much television. We still don't have time. How did they do this?
No, it astonishes me, too. I mean, Roosevelt read a book every moment he could. He was waiting for a visitor. He was reading part of it. He's waiting for his wife to come down for dinner. He's reading more of it. And he said that for a leader, books and poetry and philosophy are so important to understand human nature that you can only get it best from books and from, you know, from the great imaginative writers. And even there was one time he was in the middle of a coal strike, the most formidable industrial challenge. He brought the capitalists and the labor guys together for the first time in the White House area. And he was reading a book on the Mediterranean races in the middle of it because he needed to just relax and replenish his energies. But I think for all of them then, the print medium was the major means of communication. There's no telephone. They have to write to one another. They learn to write in ways that we may not be doing anymore.
How fast can you read a 200-page novel, Doris Kearns Goodwin?
I'm not that fast of a reader, to be honest.
Good.
You know, in fact, at night when I go to bed, I read mysteries, so I can just read 20 pages and then go to sleep.
Who's your favorite mystery writer?
Well, I've been finally somebody gave me Sherlock Holmes, so I would sound a little more classy when I was asked that question because I knew it. But I love Mary Higgins Clark, and I love Elizabeth George, and even Margaret Truman. You know, Death in the White House.
Yeah.
I read her.
You know, it's mortifying for me. Well, you two were having a highbrow discussion about authors. I am rereading the author's note that Ron Burgundy wrote. I'm sorry to do this, to ruin this otherwise wonderful discussion. Although we are no longer lovers. He's talking about Doris. This is Ron Burgundy. Because I don't know why, he says. Her knowledge of presidential history is the basis for Chapter 12. Her dogged enthusiasm for the project was only outpaced by her enthusiasm for lovemaking, which I could barely equal.
That's
right. That is
so she wore him out on Burgundy on the set.
What's the takeaway? You know, when I was reading the thing about his relationship with the press and letting them in, and the note to Steffens, you say to yourself, or a reader says to himself, I said to myself, God, there's got to be something transferable here. But then I say to myself, well, maybe there's potential for co-option. There's potential for manipulation. Obviously, you can never go back to that. What's a takeaway? If Barack Obama was sitting there and said, I know I have a horrible relationship with the press. I know Roosevelt, at least in the beginning, did it exactly the other way. Okay, Doris Kearns Goodwin, what do I take from Roosevelt and do now to fix this mess I find myself in?
I think what you take away from that is that in a democracy, even though the press is going to criticize you, you need them because they're the channel to the public, and especially in a country like ours. FDR had twice a week press conferences. Think about that. He, too, had a good relationship with the press. It's not a coincidence that Teddy and FDR were popular as a result of that. And I would say to President Obama, just have them in there more. Just know that it's going to be difficult, but they need you and you need them. And unless the country sees, you know, that partnership working somewhat more productively without co-optation, you've lost a huge element of your power.
You know,
seduce a few choice reporters, and you could
like any good politician does at any level.
I mean, Bill Weld did that in Massachusetts; had all the reporters up there to the
in
state
for beers on Fridays.
It was Amber Liquid as well.
You know, Doris, when we talked to you about Team of Rivals at our prior radio station, one of the things I asked you was the same thing we asked Ben Bradley the other day about Ted Williams, which is, did you feel like you knew Lincoln after the decade of doing this? And I know 2/3 of a decade here. When you're immersed in this and you're alone doing your research and writing, do you feel like Roosevelt or Taft are with you, or that you know them, or that they're colleagues? You know what I'm trying?
Oh, I do. Without a question. I mean, you're waking up with them every morning. You're reading their materials every day. You're reading private journals. You're reading diary entries. There's nothing like a handwritten letter as a historian looking back 100 years ago and seeing what the person said at the end of a day. In fact, the first time I saw the Lincoln movie at Spielberg's house, an early cut of it, I just thought when I saw Daniel Day-Lewis, oh, my God, this is the Lincoln I thought I knew. I mean, he walks like we knew Lincoln walked. All we knew then was that he walked like a laborer coming home at the end of a hard day, that he had a high-pitched voice, and Daniel had that high-pitched voice. And it was just miraculous for me to see in 3D the person that I knew in my head, in my imagination. So the whole movie thing was so much fun, and Spielberg's bought the rights to this one.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah. Fantastic.
So, well, we talked in the making of that movie about Teddy and Taft, so he read it in manuscript, and so it really will be fun.
Is Chris Christie going to play Taft? Yeah, that is so – I take that back, by the way.
Alrighty.
I'm really sorry. I apologize in advance.
Well,
don't send an email.
As long as you said that about Chris Christie, Jim Browdy has given many speeches in his life, and I've heard a lot of them. And
I don't think
I've ever been to a speech he's given where he hasn't used the line from Alice Longworth Roosevelt, or Roosevelt Longworth, excuse me.
You know what the line is?
Yeah, what's the line?
If you don't have anything good to say about anybody, come sit right next to me. One of the greats ever.
But you do talk a little bit about Alice in the book, The Child of the Marriage. The wife died right after childbirth. His first wife, what was her first
name? Alice was her name. That's why they named the daughter Alice.
And then he married Edith after that. But tell us a little bit about this character. She was really something.
Oh, no, she was something. I mean, it was a hard life for her in some ways because her mother died, and he had loved Teddy had loved the mother so much that he never wanted to talk about her again. It was an odd way to deal with death. And so she grew up not knowing much about her mother. Edith is a good stepmother, but still the other kids are all Edith and Teddy's. And then she gets to be an adolescent. She's beautiful and she's headstrong and she's smoking and she's drinking and doing all sorts of things. But she has the great line about Teddy that he so wanted to be in the center of things that he wanted to be the bride at the wedding and the corpse at the funeral and the baby at the baptism. I mean, she knew how to say things.
That's terrific. And wasn't he once asked about how he could control her? What was that conversation?
Yeah, somebody said to him, "Can't you control Alice because she's out there partying late at night?" He said, "I can do one of two things. I can be president or I can control Alice. I'm going to be president."
Isn't that a great line? I absolutely love it.
Can we get back to the incumbent for a second? Maybe you're right about. Do you have a relationship with Obama at all?
Yes. Oh, I got to know him because he read Team of Rivals when he was running against Hillary. So one day on my cell phone, I picked it up and he said, "Hello, this is Barack Obama.
No.
I've just read Team of Rivals and we have to talk."
Now, wait a second. Without a secretary saying the president is on the phone?
He wasn't the president. He was just running against Hillary, right? And he's way behind. So he's just a potential nominee, right? So it's like in the spring of 07. So he invited me down to the Senate office building, not to talk about putting Hillary in the cabinet like Lincoln had done, but rather he was so fascinated with Lincoln's emotional intelligence. So we talked about how he didn't retaliate against people who made him mad, how he didn't let feelings fester inside. And then what happened is when he gave Hillary the position of Secretary of State, everybody kept saying Team of Rivals. And then he asked me to put together over these last 4 years, we've had four historians dinners at the White House where we all go as like Truman and Robert Caro goes, LBJ and Meacham on Jackson or on Jefferson. And we just talk to him. You know, there's maybe 10 of us and a couple of White House people. And they've really been fun. So
yet you would say, with the exception of Hillary, and that he's not a real team of rival kind of guy.
Well, the question again is, it's true. At the beginning, he had Hillary. He had Joe Biden, who had been they'd all been minor rivals except for Hillary.
Well, and also Biden made that, I would say, pretty offensive remark about him in the debate about being articulate and that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Comment. But he chooses him as vice president. Yeah. He was going to have Richardson in the cabinet. He had Vilsack who'd run against him. He tried to get Judd Gregg. And Judd Gregg, I talked to him later. I mean, he said that Obama treated him really well when he finally declined.
Former New Hampshire senator, for those that don't recall.
And he thought that it was too big of an ideological gap. I think the problem is the relationship between the parties is so bad right now that it seems traitorous for a Republican to, as we saw with John Huntsman when he ran for president, the fact that he'd been ambassador to China in an Obama administration was held against him. So the question is, could he have done more? Possibly. But it's also true that it's harder now than it was before.
Well, I want to ask you that, too. You get the sense from your books that certainly a lot of these presidents and even the people that were in the Senate then were men of somewhat more impressive character. There were really no women then. Is that true, or am I just rose-colored glasses?
No, I think it's probably true. I mean, I think, you know, eras create great people sometimes, and that's why it's fun for me to study the Civil War, World War II, or the Progressive Era, because they feel enlarged by knowing that they're dealing with the problems of their age. And you look at the people in Washington now, and they can't be feeling it's fun to wake up every day and just go and start yelling at each other and get nothing accomplished. So I wonder whether the best people are entering public life when they have these visions in front of them.
Yeah, well, I think that's a big problem, whether the best people are entering. I would guess that a lot of the best people are not. But the other thing is, it's a similar era in terms of this whole income inequality thing when we had played the clip before from Barack Obama. And the income inequality there and the changes that they made, the Depression came shortly after that. I mean, do you see any analogies between that income inequality in Teddy Roosevelt's day and Taft's day and ours and what's going to happen to us in the future?
I mean, I think one of the things that's created the income inequality this time is a parallel to the Industrial Revolution. It's our technological revolution, which has produced a whole different economy, billionaires side by side with ordinary people struggling. Unions have diminished in size and power. And the interesting thing is that the 1920s led up to the Depression. And then World War II changed the economy once again. And we got a giant middle class for 25 years. It was full employment. People saved money that they could then spend in their suburban households. And the unions were stronger then. And there was an income tax that had been set in place with wage deductions. And then that's gone now. I mean, something happened, partially the technological revolution, partly the whole attitude toward government changed. Reagan created a generation of conservatives who believed government was the problem rather than the solution. So it's much harder now to figure out what tools the president can use to deal with income inequality right now.
And the bully pulpit is obviously one of the few that he unilaterally has the power to use.
That's right.
What did you think of Bryan Cranston in All the Way? We talked about it only 3,000 times.
Oh, he came to our house and had dinner.
Oh, my God.
He is the best guy. I mean, he's just a one. And the playwright, Robert Schenken, came another night and had dinner with us.
Tell me you're a great cook, too, Doris.
No, we went out to dinner.
Oh, good.
But
okay.
First,
we
went through my husband's boxes for him because, you know, my husband was a speechwriter for LBJ, most importantly, also Kennedy, but he wrote all of the great civil rights speeches. And we found the drafts of the speeches for the Overcome speech and the Howard University speech. I was nearly in tears because we hadn't found them before to be able to show to Cranston and Schenken. So we're going to go down to the premiere in New York.
New York City.
I thought it was like watching Daniel Day-Lewis, it was the LBJ. Both Dick and I knew. I thought it was a brilliant performance.
And you also say, it's one of these things where, let me be naive for a second. Early in the presidency, I think it was when the Affordable Care Act was on the table and was unclear if there'd be enough votes and could he get a few Republican votes? As simple as, this is long before even though I'd read your book, I hadn't, obviously All the Way didn't exist. I would say to Marjorie on the air, call in one of the Republicans, say,
absolutely,
excuse me, you know you don't like that federal government? Well, we'll stop all federal funds to your district and we'll make you happy. And by the way, this conversation never happened.
Exactly.
I mean, and that's sort of a lowbrow version of the brilliance of LBJ. He just doesn't have that thing.
I mean, LBJ was able to understand lowbrow, sanctions, promises, pledges.
Threats.
I mean, when he was trying to get Dirksen to bring the Republican minority along to break the filibuster on this 1964 Civil Rights Act to break segregation in the South. So it's a combination of promising him everything under the sun. Illinois would be sunk in all the projects. And he couldn't even do that today. It would be transparent. You know, public works projects, dams, schools, et cetera. But then he finally goes to Dirksen. He says, you know, Dirksen, you come with me on this bill. 200 years from now, school children will know only two names, Abraham Lincoln and Everett Dirksen. how can you beat that, right?
It's just unbelievable.
Do we have time for a couple more questions?
Yeah, of course we do.
I wasn't sure what time we had to go to. So I know you can't really judge someone contemporaneously. It has to go years from now. But just I do wonder if this Obamacare, Affordable Care Act gets straightened out and people have health insurance. It obviously is a big deal. When you look at his term so far, what he's done so far, that will be it, at least at this point.
I think it will be his signature legislation, as he himself has said, which is why if it doesn't get straightened out, if it doesn't work the way they thought, I think it'll be really hard. So much else was sacrificed for it. And it is a big deal. I mean, he'd be the first president in 100 years. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt tried to do it. FDR tried to do it. Truman tried to do it. JFK was hoping. And LBJ obviously got Medicare, which still will be a signature achievement for him. But it has to be straightened out quickly, I think, because otherwise there's still other legislation. Immigration reform might have been another signature act for him.
When you say might, though, just CNN's John King joins us every Tuesday, and he says the best that's going to happen on immigration is this piecemeal thing, despite the fact that recent poll showed 60%+ of the public support a pathway to citizenship. Mitt Romney lost Latinos 71-29. I naively assume that Republicans know it's in their self-interest to do something serious on immigration, even if Obama gets credit. You don't think it's going to happen either?
I don't know. I mean, it just seems incomprehensible that it wouldn't happen. But it may well be just because the way the districts are now lined up that you don't have to appeal to anybody in the country as a whole if it's just your own special interest in those districts.
Right.
And it may be that people are banking on the fact that, you know, it'll go away as an issue and something else will take its place. But it does seem its time has come. That's exactly what Dirksen said when he finally went for civil rights in 64. He said, it's an idea whose time has come. Immigration reform is an idea whose time has come, and somebody's going to get it done.
You know, if it comes, the only names they'll ever remember, Abraham Lincoln and John Boehner. Don't you agree? Hey, Doris, before you go, what's in the works? I mean, what are you doing?
Well, the only thing that I'm thinking about now is bringing all my presidents together. And because I don't want to be without one of them for a while, and studying what are the leadership traits that they shared. Because there really are five or six traits that Teddy, Lincoln, and FDR shared in particular.
We heard a rumor this morning, and from a pretty reliable source, Marjorie and I were to breakfast, that you were writing the definitive autobiography of Jacoby Ellsbury. Is there you can say it here. Is there any truth to that? You're not upset at all that he's in New York, are you?
I am upset that he's
Why?
In New York. I mean, on the one hand, only because I loved watching him on the Bates Pass, and I thought he was a good player for us. But on the other hand, you know, they were right about everything these last couple of years, the getting rid of Crawford, getting rid of Gonzalez, having a team like this team. I love this team this
these
summer.
These castaways for
no,
short
I
money
love
was
them.
Incredible.
I mean, Johnny Gomes and Shane Victorino. I mean,
you should see the look on Doris Kearns Goodwin's face as she's
well,
saying
the
these
of your
words,
book about
by the way.
What's the name of your book about the Red Sox?
Wait till next year. Well, finally, next year happened. No,
yeah.
And while I was finishing the book, I was so late. All summer long, I couldn't do anything else. I couldn't be on television because I wasn't reading the newspapers and I didn't know anything that was going on. I couldn't do lectures. I couldn't go on vacation, but I could read the sports pages. And every day almost, it seemed 97 days, they made me happy. So I promised myself, even if they lost in the fall, it would be okay. But then, of course, once they got into it and we were at all those World Series games, all the playoff games, it was the happiest time. It was just game six. Oh, my God. So in the other words, I'm going to trust their judgment. I'm sad to see Ellsbury go, but 7 years, who knows what will happen to him. So, and we'll get a lot of players in the meantime.
So you have a third World Series. You have a great new book, The Bully Pulpit, and Ron Burgundy's your lover. I mean, this woman is living the life.
Don't forget, what do we hear before she came on the air, that your son just won a big award. Brag a bit.
Yeah, no, my son, Michael Goodwin, is a teacher at Concord High School who's created this incredible interdisciplinary semester-long program for kids that range from special ed kids to troubled kids to straight-A kids. They sign up for a semester to study English, art, history, math, and science together. And they get 3 field trips a week because they got a grant from the Board of Ed. They take control of a lot of the program. They are, it's life-changing. I mean, we went to the ceremony at the end of last semester, and this one kid said he used to hate to go home and have dinner with his parents. Would say, what'd you learn in school today? Now I can't wait to tell them. And another kid said, I was a shell of a man until I took this course, and now I'm a man.
Oh,
you know,
great.
So adolescents are so, it's so important to transform them. So he was one of the 50 best teachers in the United States in a new book. So I'm very proud of him.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And congratulations on this wonderful new book. Doris Kearns Goodwin's new book is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. When we come back, we're going to look at an interesting convergence about the state of jobs in America. While fast food workers are demanding a better wage, low-skilled jobs are being replaced by machines. Is labor in America and income inequality coming to a head? That's next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. This week we're seeing man versus machine, woman versus machine, too, playing out across the country, from Amazon's drone delivery stunts, we've talked about that a lot, to Applebee's move to replace waiters, even though they say it's not true, with touchscreens. It's also happening at McDonald's. And fast food workers striking just today in 100 cities for a better wage. So what do we make of this convergence of companies outsourcing low-skilled jobs to machines, while people with low-skilled jobs demand a decent living? Is our job market woefully behind advances in technology? Does everyone deserve a right to a higher wage and a higher-skilled job? Or are lower-skilled jobs essential for people to get their foot in the job market door to begin with? Joining us to talk about the current state of the workplace and what the future might bring is Kara Miller. You know, of course, Kara is host of the Innovation Hub. Hi, Kara.
Hi. It's interesting because you have the president making these speeches about income inequality. I mean, you sort of have all these things converging at the same time, right? And people walking out of fast food restaurants and saying, you know, I want more money. And I think one of the things that the president said that actually was touched on in the New York Times in a column by Charles Blow is really interesting to think about. So if you're born in the top fifth of the U.S. In terms of money and income, your chances of staying there are over two-thirds. You're born at the top, you stay at the top. If you're born in the bottom of the bottom fifth, what's your chance of getting to the top? Less than 1 in 20. So really, you have – and it's one of the interesting things is it used to be that Great Britain was a very immobile society, right? People thought of Great Britain.
Stuck.
Right, exactly. And America was a pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You can get anywhere. You can do anything. They now have a more mobile society than we do. So here, if you're born poor, you're much more likely to stay poor. There, it's more likely you can change.
So I am one of those. What did Spiro Agnew say? Nittering nabob or nattering nabob?
Nattering
nabob of negativism. I am. When I read, in my initial reaction when I see the 60 Minutes thing with the octocopters, the drones, they're going to deliver packages 5 pounds or less, theoretically, from Amazon, is great, how exciting that is. When I hear you can have a tablet at your table at Applebee's, well, great, that'll be easy. You can order there. You can pay on there. You go to McDonald's in France and some parts of the country. Here, there's a touch screen to make your order, which means essentially 90% of the job of the person behind the counter is gone. All they do is hand you the food and whatever. So on one level, you say, hey, that's the march of progress, and it's good in some way, speeds things up. What happens to those displaced people? Where do they go? What happens?
There's only one good thing that can happen to them, which is you have to move up the sort of creativity thought chain, right? Because if you lose your job, as a fast food worker, you're not going to get a job as a bank teller because they've all disappeared.
You don't just lose your job. The job is
ATMs.
Gone. Right, exactly.
Exactly. So if you lose your job as somebody who delivers, you know, let's say the Amazon drones, and now we know Google's working on drones, and Chili's, in addition to Applebee's, mm-hmm. wants these tablets. If you lose your job at those places, you are not going to go down, probably, the income scale, because those jobs, too, are disappearing. Like I said, you know, the ATMs, those things are all disappearing.
Was the ATM, by the way, when you said that, was that the first of this, for the most part, in terms of broad consumption? Was that the first major popularly used replacement of human with machine?
Well, there are a couple things that happen.
Automation and factories.
Yeah.
I'm talking about individual consumers. I didn't mean in society
right,
as a whole.
Right, for an individual consumer. Yeah. And even that happens. See, the thing is, things happen slowly. People talk about, are there going to be massive layoffs? No. You know, there were a lot of bank tellers. And then even if you remember the first ATMs, you had to take, if you had a check to deposit, where you had to put it in
the envelope.
I
remember
that. Lick the envelope, yep. Seal it up. And somebody on the other side, an actual human being at some point that night or whatever, undid that envelope and figured out, okay, that's a check for $575 and put it in your bank account. That doesn't happen anymore, if you notice.
No, they have the little machines.
The computer
right at the counter
reads the
check.
It reads it.
It's one at a time. So, for instance, at places like CVS and Walgreens, there's a lot of turnover,
yep.
right? Well, one of the things that has happened in recent years is when people leave checkout clerks, they don't replace them because they've instituted self-checkout.
Yeah.
So that's one of the
things. And we're using it.
And we're using it. And so the question for these companies is not if, but when. I mean, there's no question that you're going to replace a human with, you know, somebody who never gets tired, never complains, never needs sick days, right? Never has, you know, children who need caring for. I mean, we're going to move towards technological
change. So
where
do they go?
So the thing is, we have to have a better education system.
That's
because
the
they have to move. We have to move towards more creativity for people, and they have to have more skills, because the things with low skills are all disappearing if they haven't already disappeared. And I think you gave a really good example of, like, if you look at a Ford plant 100 years ago, it was packed with people. Go visit a car plant now. There's like two people who work in it.
Yeah, but when you both say education and training is the key, which is, I would say, I don't mean this disparagingly, pretty obvious, the technology is so outpacing the training and the education. Well, we're all having a discussion, and the president makes a speech yesterday about the income inequality being the great challenge of his time. I assume once Applebee's and Chili's and McDonald's do this, everybody's got a tablet. Everybody's got a touch screen. How fast are they going to retrain these workers?
Well, but I don't even think it's an issue of retraining. And you know more about this than I do. But my thing is that we're not educating millions of young people in poor cities anymore.
So I ask the same question
to
both of you.
It's like a liberal arts education. If you don't learn how to think critically.
Okay, fine. So once again, the machines are coming tomorrow and the next week and the next week. The improved education access and retraining, as I call it, is not coming tomorrow. So in that interim period.
That's your fault, Jim.
I'm serious. We're in the interim period. Where are these people going?
They're staying at the bottom.
Applebee's says, by the way, they're not displacing anybody. With all due respect to Applebee's, it's ridiculous. It's of course why they're doing it. Let's take that employee. Where do those four Applebee's wait staff people who are going to be displaced, despite what where are they going to go next month?
This has already been happening. This is why in the last 35 years, even though productivity is up more than 90%, the average family's income is up only 8%. Why do things go so much to the people at the top? There's a lot of reasons, and there's certainly tax policy, and you could get somebody in here who really knows a lot about government, and they could tell you some laws that we passed. But another reason is that people who run banks and who run factories and who run Applebee's don't have to share their money, and who run CVS don't have to share their money with so many people. I mean, that's one thing that's happened. in terms of, you know, fixing schools and doing things more creatively, I have to say every single person I've talked to who is really good on this has said, if you have do something that is rote, if you do something that is repeating the same thing over and over, like, what do you want? I want a burger and fries. Okay, here it is. If you do something like that, it will be replaced. In fact, a lot of smart people think that we're going to have truckers at some point replaced by automatic fleets of trucks, because we already have excellent self-driving cars. I know it sounds crazy.
Is that going to be going down 95 with these little trucks with nobody?
Well, you know what that's called, Marjorie? That's called a train. I mean, that's essentially what a train is. It's just on a track.
But there
an autopilot is already, right. You know, we have a person, but...
But everything we've read today and everything we've heard in the last few months, and it's on the ballot in Massachusetts, is that at least right now, it certainly would help to increase this minimum wage so people that were making minimum wage wouldn't be eligible for food stamps, which is just absolutely incredible. You're working full-time at minimum wage and you're in the poverty level. I mean, that's a real problem. And you might think if you made a little bit more money, maybe you could afford to go out and take an extra course somewhere or invest in some of these online teaching things that will help you, since you're not learning anything in most of the schools.
There's
cities.
You know, there's a really interesting guy named Paul Tuff who has written about Jeffrey Canada and the Harlem Children's Zone and sort of rethinking how you change an entire community. And one of the things that Paul Tuff says is we don't spend very much in the beginning. You could look at that as wages, as education, as universal preschool, that kind of thing. And we end up paying a lot at the end. So, for example, a year to incarcerate somebody is just about as expensive as a year at Harvard. Well, a year at Harvard for your entire life, that's pretty expensive, right? So you kind of end up paying more. I mean, and I think that's one of the arguments potentially for the minimum wage at the front end.
Yeah. I mean, it's just absolutely appalling. I don't think we're going to pass it, though. But we might pass it in Massachusetts because people in the poll show are – even Republicans, who generally are small, you know, more fiscally conservative, are in favor of raising the minimum wage. And
you went to national federal minimum wages. And by the way, states over, if you have a higher state minimum wage, then that is what controls. You know what the federal minimum wage is? $7.25 an hour. That means if you're lucky enough to have a 40-hour job, and I use the term lucky loosely, which most minimum wage people do not. They're mostly part-time. That's $300 gross a week. Well, that's $15,000 a year to support your part of the family. It is surreal.
The other thing that has changed is that it used to be teenagers that were in a lot of these jobs, and now a lot of these minimum wage jobs are held by people who actually have gotten partway through college. So it's not, and they're grown-ups.
Yeah, so it becomes a permanent solution, which it isn't really
so
meant
just,
to be.
It's just kind of absolutely crazy. And then you look at, you mentioned before, the whole income inequality thing with the CEOs making 275 and 300 times what the line worker is, and that's a recent thing as well.
So I'm going to change gears here for a minute because we're running low on time. Tell us what radical connectivity is and what you are doing with it and when.
Okay, so this Saturday at 10 a.m., we are talking to a really interesting guy. His name is Nick O'Mealy, and he was the webmaster for Howard Dean. And the story of how he became the webmaster is just kind of one of these crazy things where he called up the Vermont headquarters, and he was like, you know, you guys need some help here. And it turns out that they said, hey, want to drive up to Vermont and like take a job here? And he said, are you offering me, you know, are you going to pay me? And they're like, yeah, no, not really. But he did. He had a bad week at work and he did it anyway. So anyway, we're talking to Nick O'Mealy this week, and he basically says that what we're looking at now with politics is a totally new world. So go back to 2007 and think about how Barack Obama beat Hillary Clinton in those sort of unending primaries that went on and on. Why was he able to beat her? Even though she had all the institutional money behind her, he was able to beat her because he got the small donors. She got the big donors, but he got the small donors. And the small beat the big. Nick O'Mealy talks about 1984, Gary Hart.
Terrible.
Gary Hart wins the New Hampshire primary, but he couldn't capitalize on it. Why? Because everybody sends in their checks in the mail, right? They have to unstick the envelopes with the checks. Somebody has to turn them over, endorse them. A lot of them are out of state. It takes like 3 weeks to clear. And by the time he gets the money that has come in, it's too late. He can't beat Walter Mondale, even though a lot of people in the Democratic establishment thought, well, we do support Walter Mondale, but he's running against Ronald Reagan. I don't know. Can he win? Maybe we need somebody younger, more exciting. And so this, it's the idea of radical connectivity is that small now can trump big. You know, we see it with the Tea Party. Why are Tea Party people beating Republicans in primaries? Because small amounts of donors can now trump the establishment. So it's really a fascinating idea, and we're going to talk about it.
And that's all based on the notion, which he really started with Howard Dean, who elevated use of the Internet, even in its infancy, to an art form when he's running for president, is this notion because of the web, because of cell phones and all those sort of things, the access, the ability to contact the small rather than through institutions is colossal, and that's the future in politics.
Exactly. And I should mention real briefly that Innovation Hub is going to start broadcasting nationally on Sirius XM satellite.
Look at you,
congratulations. That's
how
wonderful.
That
is fantastic.
Very exciting.
So I want to get this straight now. Innovation Hub tonight is what?
Sal Khan, who revolutionized education with Khan Academy.
I love those things.
How proud of yourself are you that you knew what was on both of your shows? You almost
I'm pretty proud.
And Saturday morning at 10 is the connectivity?
Yes, exactly. Nico Mealy talking about the end of big and the rise of the small.
Okay, how do people find out about Sirius Radio? How do we find out about that?
Just go on Sirius XM. It's going to be Saturday here at 10 p.m. on the West Coast. Isn't that crazy? On the West Coast, it'll be at 7 p.m. So tune in if you're going to be on the West Coast this Saturday.
Congratulations. It's really
Karen Miller is the host of Innovation Hub, which is going national. Good for you. Thanks so much, Karen, for being with us.
Thanks.
Great.
Okay, thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Thank you to Chelsea, Will, Alan, and Amanda. See you tomorrow.